While, meanwhile, what few social supports we've had, the way of education, health, and so on, as I'll be talking about sometime soon, just simply being sliced away, so that the very rich don't have to pay any taxes at all to support those things, and so on and so on. There's something not just insane, this is so vulgarly odious. It's like watching a brute stamping on a child's head in the street. That we would try to stop, or would we? Do we need to have it be that? Does it have to be in our living rooms before we can see what's happening? Because this is happening to billions of people. For what? So that a handful of despicable people can live insanely. Paris Hilton and the like. These abhorrent people. You wouldn't want your daughter to marry one. You wouldn't want your son to marry one. You wouldn't want your mother to have one. You wouldn't want to know one. You wouldn't want to even get near to these people. Except a lot of Americans want to be like those people. My brother is one of them. He doesn't even speak to me anymore. At all. Which pleases me, incidentally. So, let's have some discussion.
You're listening to economist Doug Dowd, part two of his lecture series on economics and society. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue with Doug Dowd.
Next time I'm going to go on to financialization, which is terribly, terribly important. Yes.
You know, I wasn't going to bring this up in a kind of a left economic concept, but you mentioned it five or six times, religion and moral codes and stuff. And I was just asking my friends if they thought that, you know, like how you talked about with the compromise of 1877, we got the New South, and now that seems to be exported to the rest of our country. And do you see any relation between those historic times there and sort of these right-wing religions we have in our country now? Well, I just want to call it oppression theology.
There's a real continuity here between the past and the present, naturally. And evangelical Christianity is something that has long roots in our history. But it comes into being for a set of reasons in a certain context. It changes in another context. It changes. Now it has changed again. And if we go on for another century, it'll change again. Because it's always responding to the social situation. I think, however, I don't wish to be over simple. I'm not worried about offending anybody, although I don't want to do that, but I don't want to be over simple. But I think it's certainly true to say that up to some very important level, the one thing that distinguishes evangelical Christians from other Christians, and there are all kinds of Christians, as we know, doesn't distinguish them totally. That is to say, there are all kinds of Christians who have some of the same feelings that evangelical Christians have. But the evangelicals have them, so to speak, fanatically, which is what distinguishes them from other Christians or non-Christians. And that is, there's a sense of sin. Okay, this is what has always been distinctive about evangelical Christians. Now, all Christians, I wouldn't say all Christians, but almost all Christians have always had some emphasis on sin in their, so to speak, in their religious education, as distinct from morality. Morality is one thing, sin is another. And the other thing about the evangelical Christians is that what distinguishes them from almost all other Christians is that they really do believe in the second coming of Christ. Okay? I mean, I don't know any Catholics who believe in the second coming of Christ. I don't know anyone who believes, except the evangelical Christians. I'm happy to say I don't know any evangelical Christians either. But the second coming of Christ is important to them for a particular reason, and that is when Christ comes, I have to say if, when Christ comes back, then all sins are forgiven, and everyone goes to heaven. What this is another way of saying is that fear is very much a part of their life. Fear and a kind of obsession with something that's, at least I see, as irrational, worried about what you're going to do after you die. I mean, that's one thing I don't give a shit about. You know, I don't want to be around, so to speak, when I'm just molding up into a bunch of stuff. So what has happened with them in this era, it isn't that they weren't always like this, it's that there's more to fear now, and there's more to fear because in our day, in the last 30 or 40 years, I put this forth as a generalization, which you can all disagree with or agree with, or part and part. There's more reason for people to have sinful feelings, if you think about sin, than ever before. You understand? We're all exposed to all kinds of temptations now we never were exposed to before. I mean, breasts and all this stuff on TV and four-letter words on TV and little girls, little boys watching this kind of stuff all the time and thinking this, wanting to do all this kind of stuff all the time. Whereas when I was 12 years old, for example, although I felt like masturbating, I thought, I think there's something wrong with this, but I couldn't figure out exactly what it was because it felt so good. There was nothing else, none of the rest of this stuff. I mean, you had to really be artful in order to find something with dirty pictures in it. Now you have to be sort of careful not to be exposed to it all the time. I mean, I can't tell you how tired I get of seeing these ads which are for some kind of a product which has always got the breasts exposed that have nothing to do with the product. But it's the way to get people to look at the ad, of course. I mean, if I were an ad maker in this world, I would do that too, you know. There's a sense of sin. I know that this sounds like a screwball thing for Doug Dowd to be talking about. That's what I think these people are doing. But it is also true that quite apart from the evangelical Christians and their support for this kind of society, it's also true that this is the kind of a world in which fear, it's universal about all kinds of things. And it's being exploited with all kinds of things, not just 9/11. But all kinds of things. Fear, I mean, the whole Social Security thing is based on fear now. Fear and greed, those two things. Almost perfect theorem to get rid of Social Security, except it's not going to work because people can read the newspapers too, a little bit at least. Now, I don't know whether that's coming anywhere near answering your question or even talking about your question, but that's what you get for asking a question. I'll teach you. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
I just came back from Venezuela, and the evangelicals in Venezuela are starting to support the people with much of what's going on with this revolution. So they're doing it kind of flip from what we normally expect.
Yeah, but they're not in the United States.
No,
I'm talking about the United States. And I might say Italy's the same way. I mean, I just say parenthetically here that I started going to Italy in 66. And one of the things that really struck me about Italian TV 66, and I don't like TV, was how good it was. And I was watching TV all the time there because they had really good everything, you know. Now, it's worse than US TV. You have a talk show. In the talk show, you got people arguing back and forth. Or it's three or four women standing with their breasts exposed on the side, and so on. Yes?
My other comment was that when you were talking earlier and asking some questions about, you know, do we have to have child heads stomped on in our home to wake up, it occurred to me several years ago, I was wondering why you weren't responding to more things like the bombing of the harbor in El Salvador and such. And it hit me that, and I thought of a lot of conversation with friends, the level of abuse in our own homes here in the U.S., sexual abuse, wife abuse, child abuse, is high enough that we aren't responding even to the abuse in front of our faces in our own homes. And therefore, I just, you know, kind of slapped my hand and said, well, why the hell did I expect us to respond to abuse 3,000 miles away when we have so much of it right here in our own homes? And we become used to it.
I think that's part of it, but I think at least as large a part is the fact that if you're talking about what's happening in Iraq, are you?
No, I was just thinking generally of why did I think that we would respond to horror is happening far away when we don't respond to horror.
I think that's very important. It's also important that we have a long-standing habit of not thinking that people in other countries are people. You know, they're people, but they're not really. So it doesn't really matter what happens.
But even if they were people, we don't stop it, right?
No, you're right about that. You know. There's an old expression about looking in the mirror and, you know, seeing the mote in your own eye. Yes?
I feel like I know someone who practices it, and I feel like what they mostly do is they're there to teach. They're there to teach a story, they're there to teach a prayer.
Well, I apologize to you if I need to. I think you're right, up to a point. But it is also true that the evangelical Christians who get the most attention, who are the most famous, who are on television, are not really gentle people the way you're talking about. I think there must be, in any group, there are good and bad people, you know, no matter what the group stands for. But the evangelical leaders, I think the ones that come to our attention, are people whose social policies, what they recommend and what they're for and against, are really very right-wing, harsh, ungenerous, and so on. I hope you're right, and I'm sure you're right about some people, certainly the ones you're talking about yourself. But, I mean, for example, whether in Italy or in the United States, I've had many experiences with evangelical Christians approaching me to try to teach me something in the street, you know. And almost always men, incidentally. Not always, but almost always men. And they've always been gentle, friendly, trying to be helpful, and so on. And what they're trying to do when they, if and when there is a conversation that I don't go away from finally, what they're trying to do is what you say. They're trying to teach about some principles of thought and feeling, morality, and so on. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I'm not a religious person, but I'm not against people being religious, especially insofar as I said earlier this evening, all religions have at their heart, whatever else they have that's not common, in common they all have systems of ethics. And without systems of ethics, our species would have gone down the tubes long ago. So I'm not against religion in that sense. And I might say, just to sort of add some emphasis to this, that in my own experience, personal experience, among the people I have found politically most effective, most wonderful, one was a Catholic priest and the other was a Catholic nun. And I'm not a Catholic. Well, my father was a Catholic, but I'm not anything in this sense. I mean, I'm not religious. But on the other hand, I've also met some awful people who were the same thing. There's nothing about Catholicism that requires people to be good or bad, but there's something about religion that can bring out the good in people, and if it's a certain kind of religious acting, it can bring out the worst in people. And the worst I'm talking about is fear. Fear is a terrible thing. It is really a four-letter word. I don't know if you were in the first meeting of the class, but I quoted Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." He didn't write that speech, but he at least said it. We really have nothing to fear. Well, I think we have lots to fear besides fear, but we have to fear fear itself because it makes you irrational. It makes you irrational. Even when you're in a dangerous situation, for example, in military combat, if you allow fear to grip you, you're likely to become irrational and behave in ways that are self-destructive. Fear rather than reason is what I mean. Okay, and fear is very much part of not everyone, but the leaders, at least, who give the gospel. Fear is what they're always talking about, in one way or another. The Lord will have punishment, and so on and so on and so on. I don't want to offend you, and I think what you said is right and relevant and worth saying. It modifies what I was saying usefully. But I ask you to take the time to pick up the newspaper and see what this evangelical reader said yesterday, or that one says tomorrow, or whatever. They're really people who are not preaching the word of Jesus at all, ethically.
I'd like to bring attention to the class struggle in the Catholic Church. We, those who represent, let's say, one end of Opus Dei and those at the other end of Operation Theology, and to posit that perhaps there is the same kind of dichotomy in simplistic terms in Protestant faiths. The example that I would give is those who crossed the line at Fort Benning in Georgia in order to protest against the rule of the Americas. I wrote to the 30 who were imprisoned about 4 years ago and congratulated them and thanked them for doing that. And got letters back from every one of them. And there were ministers and there were nuns, and one carried on a conversation with me through the mails from their penitentiary cell and asked what my faith was. And I said, "I'm a Marxist. I'm an agnostic. I'm an atheist. I don't know what's going on outside in the universe, but I do know what's going on here in my real life. And I appreciate what you've done to counteract the misery of thousands of people in South America, Central America." And he wrote back and he said that it didn't really matter what motivated me, but that we had a convergence.
Certainly.
What he called a prophetic convergence.
Well, what you had in common was humanity.
I know what you're talking about when you talk about the evangelicals. You're talking about Pat Robertson, the 700 Club, Jimmy Swaggart, the moral majority, those characters. And those are businesses. Those are
Sure.
Businesses. They own
well, they're taking advantage of Christianity, but it's also true that they couldn't have the power they have unless they have an audience that accepts that, you know. And all three of us are right about this at some degree or another.
I just to conclude with one point, and that is that these so-called faiths or religions are expanding in Central and South America because there's a political realization of the ideological right that to see a personal relationship with God instead of some intermediary is the kind of thing that atomizes a community.
Yeah, it must be said, incidentally, I think it must be added here that throughout history, going back to prehistory, it certainly must be true that for all people everywhere, life has been very, very difficult and at times terrifying and mystifying. I mean, I'm the one who's standing up here talking. I'm mystified myself. I can't figure out where it all came from, okay? And if somebody tells me God created, I want to know where God came from. You know, there's a kind of a back, and you just keep going back all the time, and so on. Life is terrifying in primitive times, but also today it's terrifying. Maybe terror is too strong a word. So that religion is, in some sense or another, what people fall back upon, I think quite reasonably, in some sense, in order to try to find some explanation, some hope, something to believe in that has a solidity to it, and so on. And, as with all things, some people come along and take advantage of that, knowingly or unknowingly, or whatever. About liberation theology, I just want to tell you one thing, in one paragraph, so to speak, only about the length of this room. The priest I was speaking about earlier, his name was Dan Berrigan, Father Berrigan, whose name many of you will know, and he and I worked together a lot, and he was a beloved friend of mine, and I like to think vice versa. And Dan was, whatever the word is, as a priest, and first thing he did was he got himself assigned into France, and he got mixed up with the workers' movement, the Catholic workers' movement there. And the church took him out of there and sent him down to Latin America, and he got mixed up with the liberation theologists there. And everywhere they sent him, so then he sent him to Cornell University, which is where I was, to be the chaplain at this. That they figured that would take care of him. Well, he became one of the leaders of the anti-war movement in doing that. And just now, just this month, as you know, we have a new pope. One of the things he made his reputation on was trying to batter down liberation theologists, which is not a very good sign for the future, because the Catholic Church, among other churches, has in it people who are inspiringly good people. And what they're trying to do, whether they're Protestants or Jews or Buddhists or Muslims or whatever their religion, fits in with what we can call liberation theology, which is to have people live an ethical, decent, wonderful life with each other and so on. That's enough of that. I give a special course on the corner up on 25th Avenue on religion every Sunday at midnight. And
you don't charge for
that. People have to bring their own beer and bring me a bottle of beer as well. Yes?
The last issue of Harper's Magazine has three very good articles about contemporary American evangelicals, and they focus specifically on an even more frightening branch of it called Dominionism, around this guy James Dobson, and the focus on the family, and they certainly focus on fear, primarily fear of sexuality, and specifically gay sexuality.
It's understandable.
And then one other good reference would be an article from New Left Review by Mike Davis about maybe a year ago, called Mega Slums, talking about what you're talking about, like these billions of people that have been forced out of, you know, agricultural life, particularly about a billion people who are living in a completely informal sector. And they have been organized, the organizations that are providing services are primarily evangelical Christians, Hindu fundamentalism, and Shia Islam. And they organize in these massive, you know, the favelas, those kinds of slums. You know, it's not the traditional left organizing.
It's a terrifying world. Somebody else. Yes.
One thing that always baffles me is living in my own little world in the San Francisco Bay Area, how anybody else can buy this shit. You know, I mean, you couldn't walk up to say somebody, you know, the United States thinks torture is wonderful. And yet there are so many people in the United States who are backing our government, who is backing an institution of torture. I mean, like really obvious stuff. We're all brainwashed to some level.
Well, socialize is a more polite term.
No, but we are all brainwashed. Yeah. To a very great level. Not just by real violence that occurs in our homes, but the virtual violence we invite into our living rooms every day. And I think when it comes down to the religious aspect of it, you're looking at an avenue that has always been, I don't want to put down religion, but brainwashing, socialization, as you like to call it, is the way that we are steeped in our moral values in the first place. It's a perfect avenue in order to further capture the minds.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I would put it in different words, however, which I think lead to different ways of thinking about what must we do or what can we do. What you're calling brainwashing, which I'm calling socialization, begins at home, for one thing. From our parents, who themselves were, as you would say, brainwashed, I would say socialized. And then it continues and becomes formalized when we go to school. And it isn't just what we're taught in school, it's what we're not taught in school. And it isn't what we're taught or not taught, it's how we're taught. It's the ways in which we think education is supposed to take place, like that, you know, not like this. And it isn't just that either. It's not just any one thing. It's that we grow up in a culture in which it becomes, so to speak, in our bones to believe that whatever happens to us is due to us. It's our due. If we do well, it's because we did well. If we do badly, it's because we did badly. I'm not talking about sin now. I'm talking about it's up to you. There is no society. There's just you in a world, doing something or not doing something, well or badly, and so on and so on. I have this little booklet, it's called Each for Himself and God for All. God in this connection, and when it's used as a slang phrase, of course, but in the United States, the God is that society which gives every person his or her due. You get what you earn. You get what you deserve. It isn't just that this is an insidious sort of a thing to say, for reasons that maybe I'll take up when we talk about education. It's wrong. I mean, did Bush get what he deserved? Did David Rockefeller, the son of John D. Rockefeller, get what he deserved? I mean, what are we talking about? You know? Does a black person get what he or she deserves, living in the South, or for that matter in the North, in the East or the West? Malcolm X once said, once you're south of the Canadian border, you're in the South. And he's right. And you don't have to be black either. You can be black, brown, yellow. You can be a Jew. You can be almost anything. Anything that's got dirt smashed on it. And we grow up, it's like we're getting injections. It isn't brainwashing, it's living. And it isn't just this country. But this country is the champ at doing this. As I say, because we don't have any traditions to speak of except make money, look out for yourself, and have contempt for the people who are badly off. I mean, I can't stand the discussions about the homeless people. I just can't stand them. It's just hideous. I mean, as though anyone wants to be homeless. As though any of those people who, some of them are on drugs. As though they wanted to be on drugs. As though they went to school and they said, I want to go, I can't wait to, and I'm on drugs. That's bullshit. It's just dirty, rotten bullshit. In the first place, a good many of the people who are on drugs are Vietnam vets, and so on. The notion that what you get is what you deserve is crazy. I used to start out my introductory economics classes. I would say, okay, here I am, Professor Down. Got a good job. I'm powerful with respect to you. Now, do you think I would be standing up here having that power, having this good job? I was born in San Francisco, white, in a middle-class family. Do you think I would be standing up here if I'd been born in rural Mississippi, black, a little girl? Do you think I would be standing up here if I had a chance, born in 1919 in rural Mississippi? Bullshit. I have nothing to do with my birth. When, where, color, anything. Neither does she, the little girl. What are you talking about? You get what you deserve. You get what you're lucky or unlucky enough to have been plunged into, or dropped into, or built into. And in what year? Not just what place, what color, what class. What year? 1919? I wouldn't trade with anybody who was born in 1982 or 85, to say nothing of 2005. I wouldn't trade with any of them. They got really hell awaiting them. I had hell awaiting me too. Depression, war, etc., etc., but nothing like what's coming up. Nothing like what's coming up. I read you that little thing that China in 2011 will have an economy as strong as ours. And in the process of China getting that economy and using it much more efficiently, much more powerfully than any capitalist country has ever done before, run as they are by a totalitarian communist bureaucracy. What they will be doing, in addition to everything else, is making China into a consumer of raw materials, not least of all oil, and using them in such a fashion that along with all the other countries in the world, we'll be lucky to be able to breathe 50 years from now. Breathe 50 years from now. We use, because of a novel or a mill film or something, the tipping point. The tipping point has been reached. I think it's inconceivable that we can do what we have to do to save Mother Nature, to save the environment. It's inconceivable because we have to have a whole change of life, not just in the leading capitalist countries, in the whole rest of the world. We have to just stop living the way we live. That doesn't say live worse. It means living better, but very differently, which is something we can think about or talk about in the future or read about. So when you were born, where you were born, that's a, but most of us can't shake this notion, hey, it's my fault. And we love the notion, if we're well off, saying, hey, I did it. Bullshit. Very dangerous bullshit. And so when we look at the poor in this country, or we look at the poor in other countries, we figure, it's their problem. Why don't they get off their ass and work? Not paying any attention at all to the fact that if you've got 400, 500 million unemployed in China, they don't want to be unemployed. They don't want to be desperate. They've been pushed off their land by their government. A communist government pushed them off their land. They don't have a chance unless they go to work for wages. And so on and so on. I mean, what are we talking about? We're not talking about anything. We're not talking. We're not thinking at all. We're just taking stereotypes as models for ourselves as well as others. That's what socialization is about. It isn't brainwashing so much. I mean, brainwashing is too simple a term. For one thing, it sort of has a ring of some people designed this whole thing. The people who are in power are themselves socialized to think they're great guys. Great guys, really great guys. Bush thinks he's a wonderful guy. He's a piece of shit with wheels. He thinks he's wonderful.
What I'm seeing when I look at a television program is they're not even having logical arguments.
Of course not.
You know? I mean, anybody with any brains could see that one person asks a question and that person answers an answer that's not even an answer to that question.
Yeah, well, that's all right. The president does that too. Do you see his press conference the other night? He was asked a question, he answered something
that's
else.
Right.
Anyhow, I think we have to close. Next time we'll go on with financialization and that sort of stuff.
You've been listening to part two of Doug Dowd's 2005 class series on understanding the relationship between economics and society. Part three will be broadcast in 2 weeks. Thanks to Michael Slaughter of Vivecchio Press for these recordings. For more on Doug Dowd, visit www.dougdowd.org. That's DOUGDOWD.org. Earlier this month, two major conferences on media reform took place, one in St. Louis and one at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. The talk by U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders we're about to hear was from the University of Illinois Conference on Media Consolidation.
Thank you, Bob. If you are concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about women's rights, health care, foreign policy, Iraq, the economy, if you are concerned about any of those issues, you must be concerned about the media. We have got to make corporate control over the media a political issue in the same way that health care and education and Iraq is a political issue. And that means that when somebody runs for office and comes before you and they talk about the issues, you raise your hand and say, what are you going to do about corporate control over the media? And after the candidate recovers, after his fall on the ground, he or she will start responding. But we have got to make it a political issue because it is as important or more important than any other issue that we talk about. Let me begin by telling you how I first recognized that media was a huge issue. Way back in the 1970s, before I became mayor of Burlington, Vermont, I did a little bit of independent writing. And I did a video, if you like, not quite a film, on the life of Eugene Victor Debs, who some of you know was one of the great labor and socialist heroes in America. And I did it because nobody in Vermont, none of the kids and kids in America today do not know who Debs was, as they do not know the names of many great American heroes. Well, we did the video, And it was not very sophisticated, but it was a fairly, I thought it was a fairly good video done for a few $1,000s. And we took it to our local public television station. And we said, here's a video, and we'd like you to run it. And they looked at it, and 1 month went by, and 2 months went by, and 3 months went by, and then they finally wrote back, and they said, sorry, Mr. Sanders, we can't use your video because it doesn't tell both sides of the story. Because as you know, on all programming that you see on public television, you always hear the socialist and capitalist point of view, the progressive and conservative. That's the way it is. But so they couldn't put it on. Well, that got me a little bit upset, and it turned out that in Vermont, there were other people who were not necessarily political, but they were local filmmakers, Vermont filmmakers, and they were unable to get their films on Vermont public television. The result of that is we started a little bit of a movement, and we put pressure on our local public television station. And the outcome of it was one of the great nights of my life that I will never forget. The University of Vermont, which owned the public television station, agreed to negotiate with us, and we worked out a town meeting of the air on prime time, 3 hours, prime time Vermont public television, to discuss what should public television in Vermont be. So we had about 15 people from the establishment who thought the status quo was good, and we brought 15 people who wanted change. And then the guy who was moderating it opened up the phone lines. And this is the truth. So many phone calls came in that the phone line to that station in Winooski, Vermont, actually broke down. So I got the clue that media was an important issue. And as Bob mentioned, I think our office held the very first town meeting on corporate control over the media a number of years ago. Jeff Cohn, who's one of the founders of FAIR, came to Vermont. And Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been up. We held a meeting with Michael Copps, who on media consolidation has been doing an outstanding job as a member of the FCC. We had 600 people coming out to St. Michael's College to discuss that issue. So anyone who tells you that media is not an important issue is missing the boat completely. It is enormously important, and the people of America want serious discussion and resolution on the issue. And let me tell you some of the concerns that I have with what's going on in the media today. Am I concerned that when I am asked to speak about an issue like Iraq, I get 6 seconds to respond, yep, I'm concerned. Because I can't, and you can't, and nobody can discuss an issue intelligently in a 6-second soundbite, which is what dominates television, which is the most important medium in our country. Am I concerned that by definition, corporately owned media is pro-corporate? Yeah, I am very concerned about that. We see the manifestations of that all over the place. We saw the difference between how the corporate media treated a moderate Democrat like Bill Clinton as opposed to a conservative Republican like George Bush. We saw how they covered the lead-up and the war in Iraq, so that millions of Americans, in order to get unbiased news, had to go to the CBC in Canada or the BBC. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. Am I concerned that the media seems to think that one of the major issues facing civilization today is the Michael Jackson case, or maybe, break it to you, Britney Spears is pregnant. It's true. Am I concerned about that? I sure am. But of all of those concerns and many more, let me tell you what my deeper concern is. My concern is not just what the media reports or discusses and the slants that it has on the issues. That's important. But the deeper concern is what the media does not talk about. And as an elected official, as a public official, this is of huge concern to me, and I will tell you why. If media does not reflect the reality of people's lives, does not talk to people in a way that they say, yeah, that's me, that's my experience. If media ignores the reality of people's lives, then people end up thinking, gee, I'm making $8 an hour. I can't afford to take care of my family. I must be the only person in America in that position. It's my fault. And I don't have any health insurance. I guess I must be lazy or irresponsible. It must be my fault. It's not a political issue. It's not a social issue. It's not a solvable issue. It's just my issue. So let me just talk about some of the issues that the media does not talk about. To my mind, the most significant non-discussed issue in American society is the collapse of the middle class. In the last 30 years, there has been an explosion in technology and worker productivity. That means that every one of you is today or will be in the future far more productive than people who held your job or a similar job 30 years ago. One might think that with that explosion of technology and worker productivity, that the average American would either be making more money by working the same number of hours, or in fact, making the same amount of money and working fewer hours. That's what one might think. The reality, of course, is that despite this huge increase in worker productivity, the middle class is shrinking. People are working longer hours for lower wages. Poverty is increasing, and the standard of living of millions of people is in decline. When I was a kid, the expectation was that one breadwinner in a family, in those days usually the male, one, could work 40 hours a week and earn enough money to pay the bills. Today, you don't know any family, any middle-class family who's in that position. Husbands and wives, people are working incredible hours. In my state, it is not uncommon for people to work not one job, but two jobs, but three jobs to make enough income to get health care, to get the benefits that they need. That is the story of our time, and that is the story that the media does not talk about. One of the reasons that the middle class is shrinking is that we are seeing an unprecedented gap between the rich and the poor in America today. Richest 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. CEOs of large corporations earn more than 500 times what their workers make. Wealthiest 17,000 families earn more income than the bottom 20 million American families. You have an economic issue, is that wealth is being created, but it's going to the people on top. Now you tell me how often you hear that issue on television or radio. That's about right. That's close to exactly right. It is a non-discussed issue. So in a world where we talk about family values and morality, forget economics here, how often are we posing the question of the appropriateness of seeing in this country a huge increase in billionaires while at the same time we have the highest rate of childhood poverty, 20%, in the industrialized world? Who is posing that moral question? Haven't heard Pat Robertson speaking about it lately. Everybody knows, even my colleagues in Congress, that our health care system is disintegrating. We all know that 35 million Americans have no health insurance, more are uninsured. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And yet, most Americans do not know that the United States of America is the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right of citizenship. Have you seen the programming on television talking about that simple fact? Very often in Vermont, I go out and I talk to kids a lot. I love doing that. I go to almost every high school in the state. And I say to kids, tell me, how much does it cost? You know, kids are all struggling to figure out how they're going to afford to go to college. How much does it cost to go to college in Germany? And some kids say, I think it's free in Germany, which it is. How many Americans understand that higher education in Europe, Scandinavia, and even Canada is substantially lower, in some cases free? And why is that? And what does that have to do with Europe? You know, Europe has its share of serious problems. When you get pregnant in the United States, we fought very hard, and we are going to get you a 3-month family leave. Wow. You can't get fired when you get pregnant. Isn't that something? How many Americans know that in European countries you get 6 months of 8 months with guaranteed payment, with 50-75% of your paycheck coming in? So in this country, after you have a baby, yeah, you can't get fired by staying home, but if you don't have any money, you have to go to work anyhow. How many people know that? Do we talk about that? The United States today has a $618 billion trade deficit. Our entire trade policy is a gross failure. We have lost millions of decent-paying jobs, and we're about to hemorrhage millions of good-paying information technology jobs. What about? I had fun recently. Last month, I had the opportunity to testify before the Ways and Means Committee on trade. And when you ask people about the propriety of having American workers forced to compete against people who make 30 cents an hour and go to jail, as they do in China when they try to form a union, you know what? Nobody has a response. And yet every editorial page of every major newspaper in America has supported NAFTA and free trade with China. How often do we hear that discussion in the news? The president, whenever you see the president, he is always or very often in front of the military people. The background is the troops behind them, giving a speech telling us how much he loves the troops. How often have you seen in the newspapers the fact that this president's budget has slashed, decimated health care for veterans in this country? Slashed it. So when people ask themselves, they say, why is it that working class people vote against their own economic interest, which many do? One of the reasons is that the economic reality facing the working class of this country is very rarely discussed. In fact, even the concept of working class, working people as a class, is not acknowledged. Question. Here it is. You ready? You're all very bright people here at the University of Illinois. Name me 3 leaders of the American working class. What is this guy talking about? What does that mean? There's nobody. What? What does that mean? You don't know anybody. There is nobody. You got tens of millions of people who are in the working class. You define it however you want to. People who are struggling to keep their heads above water. Who are the leaders? We don't know who the leaders are. We don't recognize working people as a class. So how do we go forward if we can't even define that? How many of you have seen on television, we have many, many, millions of workers, not enough, numbers are going down, in trade unions. You tell me, and I want you to be honest, how many of you have ever seen a program on television discussing the role and the positive role that trade unionism has played in America in improving the lives of the American people? Anybody seen a program? There are, every morning, a few people at CBS and NBC and the New York Times and so forth who decide this is the news today. But that news, time and time again, ignores the real reality facing the people of America. Just last night, I held a town meeting in a small town called Springfield, Vermont. And we had 250 people out to talk about poverty. And they were not intellectuals, they were not academics, they were poor people. And they wanted to talk about the experiences of their lives, living without health care, working at Walmarts, and so forth and so on. Think about what would be happening in this country politically if we had serious discussion on those issues, if people knew that they were not alone, if people learned about how change could take place when people work together. So when you talk about media, probably the most significant thing is that corporate media deflects attention away from the reality facing the vast majority of our people. And our job is to bring reality home so we could take a cold, hard look at what goes on and then figure out how we can improve the situation. But if we don't see that reality, we're never going to be able, in my view, to improve it. Just let me carry that argument just for a few more minutes into foreign policy. Our president, as you know, is a great believer in freedom. He wants to bring freedom all over the world. In the 1980s, some of you may remember that President Reagan spent God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars bringing freedom to the people of Nicaragua. And if many of you were adults at that time and you were reading the newspapers, you knew that almost every single day, Nicaragua, a tiny, tiny country in Central America, every day it was on the front pages of the newspapers. If a Sandinista policeman pushed somebody, it was literally a front page story. Well, the Sandinistas lost, the Contras came to power. You go to your computer and you check out how many stories have been written about Nicaragua in the last 10 or 15 years as they celebrate and enjoy the freedom that the Reagan administration brought to them. And you're not going to find very much written at all. It's a non-story now. But what you might find, if you look hard enough, is that unemployment in Nicaragua, the last time I looked, was about 50%. 50, that's a 50%. Last time I looked, and that was a year ago, there were some instances of starvation in Nicaragua. Last time I looked under their free society, and this is a very poor country, a crooked president managed to steal over $100 million, which is quite a feat from a country that has no money at all. Did you ever hear much discussion? Did it make the front page of the New York Times? I don't think so. And that's an important lesson when we talk about, quote unquote, freedom in Iraq as well. One of the issues, obviously, that we are dealing with in Congress right now is the issue of media consolidation. All of you know or should know that several years ago, Bush's chairman of the FCC, Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, led an effort toward what they called media deregulation. And what that meant, essentially, is that at a very dangerous moment in our history, when as a result of mergers and consolidations, fewer and fewer large corporations control what we see, hear, and read, the numbers getting smaller and smaller, these guys said, that's not good enough. We have to make it even fewer. And never forget that in the waning days of the Soviet Union, you know, people thought, well, there was one newspaper and one television station. There were not. There were many, many newspapers, many radio stations, many television stations. The only problem was is that they were all controlled either by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or by the government of the Soviet Union. What do you think is happening in America today? You're looking at a handful of large media conglomerates, Disney, Viacom, News Corp, General Electric, Time Warner, and a few others controlling almost everything that you see, hear, and read. It is not just television. It is radio. It's not just radio. It is book publishing. It is magazines. It is the movie houses. And you're seeing fewer and fewer control that. So the Bush administration looked at this problem and said, we want even fewer corporations to control it. So they put through some rules which were a disaster, which would have allowed fewer companies to control what we see, hear, and read. Among many other things, what their regulations would have done is done away with rules regarding cross-ownership. What this means is in a town like this, Champaign-Urbana, you could end up, if Bush gets his way, with one media corporation owning your local daily newspaper, a television station, radio stations, and your cable outlet. One company owning all of that. The good news is, to the FCC and Michael Powell's surprise, people rose up against those regulations. And millions of emails came into the FCC, 99% of which said, do not allow for more media consolidation. And then members of Congress began to raise the issue. And we had an interesting coalition coming together, not just progressives like myself, but a lot of conservatives came together on that issue. The end result is that by a 2-1 decision, an appeals court in Pennsylvania threw out what the Bush administration did, and we're back to the drawing boards. So we have some time. But on this issue of media consolidation, I would hope that all of you will stand up and fight. Fight for localism. Fight for a radio and television station locally owned, which will deal with what your school board, what your city council, what the people in this community deal with. Fight for diversity, for people of color to be able to own radio and television stations. Fight to make sure that when you turn on radio or television, you're not just going to hear the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world, but you're going to hear the Amy Goodmans and other points of view as well. There is another issue that is going on right now that is also of huge concern, which not a lot of people know about, but it is terribly important, and you should know about it, and you should be actively involved on this issue. A couple of months ago, by a very strong vote, against my vote, the House of Representatives voted to raise the fines for quote-unquote indecency. And what this means is that if somebody is on the Amy Goodman show and starts throwing out four-letter words, somebody could call up and say, I was absolutely offended by that. And if people wanted, they could fine the guest or her, if this bill goes through, $500,000. And I doubt that you could sustain that. In my state now, the fellow who is head of Vermont Public Television wrote to me and he said, as a result of what they are doing, we are now looking, taking a very hard look at the programming that we do. We do independent films. We're going to look very hard about what we're going to put on the air. How many of you saw a very good film called Saving Private Ryan? Won 5 Academy Awards, starred Tom Hanks. ABC, last November, in honor of Veterans Day, decided to air that film across the country. Unbelievably, over 60 ABC affiliates on Veterans Day refused to show a film depicting the incredible sacrifice and heroism of those men who fought and died on D-Day and for the liberation of Europe. Didn't show the film. Do you know why they didn't show the film? These are ABC affiliates, not little rinky-dink radio stations. The affiliates were afraid that in the course of the show, profanity was used by soldiers. And they were afraid that if they showed that film depicting the real-life struggles of men under attack, that they would be fined. So if ABC affiliates, ABC, one of the major corporations in our country, is afraid to show an Academy Award-winning film, believe me, there is a chill. There is a movement towards censorship in America. But obviously, it's not only Saving Private Ryan. The Chancellor, a moment ago, mentioned that there was a PBS program whose goal is to show how different people make different products and how we're all one country and we all do different things. Well, they came to my state. They came to Vermont. And it turns out that there was a gay couple who were making maple syrup. The new Secretary of Education contacted the PBS and said, we do not want you to send this program out over the airwaves. So they didn't, and people could show it independently, but they didn't send it out nationally. Some of you may remember that MoveOn.org wanted to run an ad, pay for an ad, pay a pretty price, I should tell you, for an ad on the Super Bowl, which criticized President Bush for running up the highest deficit in our history. And CBS said, sorry, we're not going to put that ad on the air. The United Church of Christ developed an ad which essentially said that we as a church welcome gay people into our church. CBS and NBC said, nope, that's too controversial. Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns a number of affiliates, decided not to put a Ted Koppel show on the air, which in a sense was a memorial for men and women who had died in the war in Iraq. It was too anti-war, according to those people. Now, if these guys get away with what they want, which is to raise the indecency fine from $32,000 to $500,000, trust me that people are going to be looking over their shoulders all over this country in terms of what's on the air. Now, that is very bad. Let me tell you what is potentially much worse. And that is, we have some people, like Senator Stevens of Alaska, who has said, yes, of course we have to crack down on programming on over-the-air television, which the FCC has regulated for many years. But that's not enough. We now have got to go to cable. We have got to go to satellites. We have got to go to the Internet. That's Senator Stevens. Now, what does this mean? What it means in practical terms is that programs like Bill Maher's program, Jon Stewart's program, The Sopranos, they're going to be off the air. They're going to be off the air or pushed very late into the night or radically changed. And for the first time, the FCC is going to venture into cable in an area which many of us, including, interestingly enough, Michael Powell, believes is unconstitutional. The FCC has not gone into cable. It's not over the air. You're paying for it, and they're now saying we can go into your homes, even though you're paying $50 a month or more to get this programming, and because fundamentalists do not like that program, you can't watch that. And then the president tells us about freedom in Iraq. So what do we do? Number one, for any serious progressive, the issue of media consolidation, the issue of censorship, the fight to create a media where different points of view can be heard, the fight to break down the situation where so few control so much in media, should be one of the most important issues, if not the most important issue, that you deal with. And interestingly enough, on that issue, you're going to find a lot of support out there from people with very different political persuasions. Very few people think that it is the American way to have a few corporations controlling what we learn about and what we see and what we hear. And in terms of this censorship issue, reach out to everybody you know. People do not have to be progressive. People do not even have to be political to know that it ain't right for commissars in Washington, D.C., to tell them whether or not they could watch The Sopranos. I think that this is an issue that can generate a lot of public support. I think that the Bush administration has completely overreached on that issue, and I think we can win it. Issues of media have now risen substantially in terms of public discourse in America. This issue is so significant that even the media occasionally mentions it. So it is a huge issue. If we believe in a vibrant democracy, it's an issue that we must be concerned about. And when we open up media in America and we allow the people to hear different points of view, we can begin to change America in all the ways that it must be changed. Thank you very much.
That was U.S. Congressmember Bernie Sanders speaking on May 10th at the University of Illinois Conference on Media Consolidation. Thanks to Paul Reichmandel of MediaGeek for that recording. You can download MP3s of this and other episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
We'll always be filled by